This is the Everything Financial Radio Program. I am your host, Dennis Tubergen. Glad you decided to tune in today. Everything Financial Radio is brought to you by PLP Services. You know, I've got a really special guest today, Mr. Mike Mish Shedlock, for three segments. I caught up with Mish this past week and talked to him about what's going on in the economy. Could negative interest rates be coming to the U.S.? Are we really seeing falling food prices? And does that mean deflation is about to set in? I had a great conversation with Mish. I'll be sharing the entire conversation with you on today's program. Also want to remind you, if you're between the ages of 55 and 69, we do have a couple of free educational resources that will likely be of some interest to you. We have Social Security Maximization Seminars. They begin at 6 p.m. and conclude at 7:30 p.m. with a complimentary dinner. If you're wondering about the best way to collect your Social Security benefits, I'd encourage you to go check out the details at socialsecurityradio.com. We've got a meeting at Stonewater Country Club on September the 8th and at Boulder Creek Golf Club on September the 13th. Again, the website to visit is socialsecurityradio.com. I'm extremely pleased to have back here on the Everything Financial Radio Program returning guest Mike Shedlock, also known as Mish. You can read his excellent and prolific writings at mishtalk.com. That's M-I-S-H-talk.com. I'd encourage you to do that. You can also Google Mish, M-I-S-H, and he's the first thing that pops up. And Mish, welcome back to the program.
Hey, a pleasure to be back on, Dennis.
Mish, you know, you wrote a couple things recently that caught my eye. One, do you believe there's food price deflation? And you also reported on the Case-Shiller home price index declining. So I guess big picture question here for you. Are we now seeing a shift away from inflation towards deflation?
Well, without a doubt, food prices have come down, but we need to look at this in perspective. There's a number of reasons. There's a drought that caused cattle prices, and thus the price of beef to skyrocket a couple years ago. Prices have come down over the last year, maybe a little bit longer, depending on what kind of food we're talking about here. But they're not back where they were, Dennis. I do the shopping for our household, and actually, I've done it, you know, all my life. I've always been the shopper, and I worked in a grocery store. My gosh, all the way back in 1967, giving away my age a little bit here. But and I worked at grocery stores in high school and a little bit in junior college. And the sale price of chickens back then, on sale, we had farmers coming in buy these things. They were a loss leader, 21 cents a pound. You can still buy whole chickens. You can sometimes find them on sale for 59, 65, 69 cents a pound. If you average that out, we're talking about something like, you know, a 1%, you know, annual increase in the price of chickens. And you can do the same thing for almost anything food related and come to a similar conclusion. Now, but what's happened recently, for the last 10 years actually, ribeye steaks on sale might be like $4.99 a pound or so, and now they doubled. Now on sale they're $7.99 a pound or $6.99 a pound if you're lucky. So food prices haven't fallen back to where they were, say, 7 years ago even. So they really skyrocketed, and now they're falling. So, you know, do you call that deflation? Depends on your time frame here, Dennis.
Well, Mish, maybe for our listeners that hear the terms inflation and deflation and aren't familiar with exactly what they mean, give us just a layman's, you know, 101 type of definition.
Well, we're talking here. What we were just discussing was price inflation and price deflation. That's really not the best way to look at it. I view inflation as a monetary phenomenon, which is an increase or decrease in money supply and credit, and my definition is actually a little bit more complicated than that, but let's just leave it there. So what we've seen without a doubt is massive inflation in financial assets. We saw that in 2000 with the dot-com bubble. We had a dot-com bust. The Fed lowered interest rates, created a housing bubble. We had a massive bubble in home prices and also financial assets, bank stocks, the like, that burst in 2007. And we're back here again, Dennis. This, if we look at financial assets, stocks are the most insanely overpriced, one of the top three in history. We're back right there in terms of financial bubble where we were in 2007, 2000, and the third one is 1929. That's how out of place stock prices are here now. Corporations are going into debt not to expand, not to build business, not to improve their technology. They're borrowing money to buy back shares to maintain earnings per share ratios. And despite that, earnings have been falling, and stocks are priced like they were in 1929. It's really amazing that we've blown another bubble. That is a result of inflation.
And Mitch, let's just go back and examine that, because I want our listeners to understand what it is exactly that you just said. I mean, if you're a corporation and you're going into debt to buy back shares of stock, which means there are fewer shares of stock out there, mm-hmm. that means that the earnings are actually spread over a fewer number of shares. Isn't that a house of cards? Isn't that a shell game?
Absolutely. It goes on. It's one of the symptoms. It's one of the things that you could spot at every market top. Actually, in 2006, remember they were talking about there was a shortage of homes. People were standing in line in Florida, these lines wrapped around the corner, just to get into a lottery for the right to buy a Florida condo. 3 weeks later, there were no lines. That's how fast, you know, sentiment can change. And prices still hung around for a while. They did. But it was more of a mirage than anything. The builders started giving incentives, you know, free cars, free vacations, free granite, an extra room, you know, a carpet, you know, all these incentives. So it looked like the price was stable, but, you know, they're throwing $40,000, $50,000, $100,000 swimming pools sometimes into these things to sell these houses. Then finally demand just absolutely crashed, and prices would too. People decided to take profits, and guess what? They couldn't sell the house for what they thought it was worth just sometimes 2 months earlier.
Mitch, I've got time for just one more question in this segment. You know, when you mentioned that you had to stand in line mm-hmm. for the ability to get into a lottery to decide yes. if you would be allowed to buy a Florida condo, yes. I thought about the terms irrational exuberance, coined by Alan Greenspan. Mm-hmm. I thought about speculative mania, collective madness. I mean, all those things seem to describe a market top, and that certainly is illustrative of that. Are you seeing something similar as far as irrational exuberance now in the stock market?
Well, I mean, just these statements. We've seen a lot of statements. What was the one on Facebook yesterday? I'm trying to remember. Oh, the Swiss National Bank has bought billions of dollars worth of Facebook. It's out there in an attempt to destroy their currency. They don't want their currency strong, so the Swiss National Bank is out there buying all of these assets, trying to cheapen the Swiss franc. And there were some comments on that from analysts from, ooh, I can't remember. I'm going to say Commerce Bank, but I might have the bank wrong here. Analyst said, well, it makes perfect sense for the central banks to be buying stocks. And I said, what? It makes perfect sense for the central bank of Switzerland to be buying Facebook. And the same thing is happening in Japan, actually in Japan on a much larger scale by volume, but in terms of percentage of assets, the Swiss National Bank is actually in the lead on a percentage basis in terms of its the size of its economy, in terms of what it's doing. You know, for people to say that it makes sense for the central bank of Switzerland to be buying shares of Facebook at an astronomical PE, and then to say, you know, there's room for them to buy even more. Yes, hallelujah. Yeah, that is the kind of mentality and sentiment that marks top. I'm not saying this is a top. I'm just saying this is the kind of sentiment that you see here when people say that these kinds of things, quote, make sense.
Well, we are chatting today with Mr. Mish Shedlock. His website is mishtalk.com. I'd encourage you to check it out. I'll continue my conversation with Mish when Everything Financial Radio returns. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program brought to you by PLP Services. Glad you decided to tune in today. Hope you're enjoying my conversation with Mr. Mike Mish Shedlock. If you'd like to read more about what Mish has to say, you can do that by visiting his blog website. That's at mishtalk.com. Also, a quick reminder, we do have a couple of Social Security Maximization seminars coming up here in the West Michigan area, one on September 8th, one on September 13th. You can get more information by visiting socialsecurityradio.com. I have the pleasure of chatting today with Mr. Mish Shedlock. If you're just joining us, his website is mishtalk.com. That's M-I-S-H-talk.com. You can also Google the term Mish, and he's going to be the first guy you see pop up. And Mish, let me just pick it up where we kind of talked about, where we left off in the last segment. We started out by talking about the fact that food prices are declining. At the same time, you're seeing stock prices advancing. That doesn't seem to make sense. How do you square that?
Well, that's one of the things we talked about in the last segment, but corporations are going into debt, buying just to buy back their own shares. And there's a number of corporations that actually have legitimate cash on their balance sheet. You know, Google, Apple, these corporations are... Microsoft actually sitting there with cash in hand. And one of the weird things, though, is we see all of these all this analysis that, you know, these corporations have all this cash on hand, except for the handful of technology companies that are really, you know, bringing in cash hand over fist. Most of the cash on balance sheets is actually nothing more than debt. You know, if you look and you see the pile of cash, and then you actually go out there and look at how much debt these corporations have, they have way more debt, tens of times more debt than they actually have cash. Yet you hear this statement, ooh, you know, look at all this cash on the sidelines. Cash on the sidelines is a function of expansion of credit and the asset buying for trillions of dollars worth by the Fed. You know, someone has to hold that cash when they pump this into the economy. So and the weird thing about this is they say, well, this cash is going to come into the market. You hear this, oh, just wait till this cash comes into the market. It can't. It's impossible for cash to come into the market because if someone buys $1 million worth of Microsoft or Amazon or Facebook or anything, then someone else is selling $1 million worth. So the cash on the sidelines never changes. It's a function of credit expansion and what central banks are doing. Yet you hear this argument all the time. Wait till this cash comes into the market. It can't, because except at IPO time, because otherwise, for every buyer of a stock, there's someone else that the cash transfers to someone else.
Well, we're chatting today with Mr. Mish Shedlock of MishTalk.com. And Mish, we were chatting before we started to record our conversation here that Stanley Fischer, who is vice chair of the Federal Reserve, made some interesting comments. He talked about the fact that negative interest rates seem to be working really, really well. Can you comment?
Yeah, we wonder what planet these guys are on. The banks in Europe are hurting. Negative interest rates. Let's just compare what the Fed is doing versus what the ECB is doing. In Europe, they have negative interest rates. So banks are actually charged to hold money with the ECB. Here in the United States, and it's a major big handout to our banking system, and it's been going on since the crisis, we actually pay bank interest on their reserve. So here we are, taxpayers are actually sending money here in the United States. It's a free handout to the banks. In Europe, the banks are being charged interest to hold the money on deposit with the ECB. And it's a drain on their banking system over there. And their banking system is in absolutely horrendous shape. The Italian banking system is without a doubt insolvent. And if it's insolvent, it would cause a cascade effect to ripple through. So the entire European banking system is insolvent, in my opinion. It's yet we have this statement that from Fisher that these things are working. So allegedly, negative interest rates are working and positive interest rates are working. And so, well, that's Europe and this is the United States. But this is all groupthink. But the thing that really stood out that Fisher said, here's a quote, negative rates are difficult to deal with for savers. They typically go, quote, quite decent with equity prices. So here this guy is promoting negative interest rates because it's good for the people who hold stocks. So he said that. I looked at that and I said, my gosh, I cannot believe this guy actually said this. Now, it's true. I just can't believe they said it. And that's what's going on here is we've built this bubble and the central banks have been trying to force up the price of assets. In Japan, the Japanese central bank owns a massive percentage, something like 70% of all Japanese debt. It's just sitting there. They've run out of debt to buy. So Japan, too, is buying stocks. And the largest pension fund in Japan, which used to invest in primarily bonds, started investing in the stock market, and they lost something like $53 billion for the quarter because stock prices have gone. And the headline title that came out of Bloomberg is, because of the decline in prices, they've got room to buy. This is the way that these people are thinking, and central banks are propping up share prices. The question, Dennis, and no one knows the answer to this, is how long this goes. Because once sentiment changes, and it's going to, because that's what it has to happen if we're in a bubble, and I believe we're in a bubble, then eventually, as happened in 2000, prices hit such a point that people no longer wanted to buy technology stocks. The home prices hit such a level in 2006 that people no longer wanted to buy homes, and it's going to happen again, and it's going to be pretty interesting to see how central banks respond to that when it happens.
We're going to have to leave it there. The good news is we're going to have Ms. Shedlock for one more segment today on the Everything Financial Radio program, and we'll continue our conversation with Ms. after these words.
Give me your money. Just give me money.
Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program brought to you by PLP Services. We have the pleasure today of chatting with Mr. Mike Shedlock, otherwise known as Mish. I'd encourage you to check out his blog at mishtalk.com. And Mish, we talked in the last segment that Stanley Fischer, the vice chair of the Fed, said that negative interest rates were good for share prices.
Yeah, here's the quote. They go quite decent with equity prices. Unquote.
You know, when I think back, another Fisher, Mr. Richard Fisher, who is now, I believe, retired, who is, I believe, president of the Dallas Federal mm-hmm. Reserve Bank, earlier this year in a CNBC interview said that he was part of a group at the Fed that put $1 trillion into the stock market to front load a market rally. So is the Fed's primary job now just to juice the stock market?
That's what it seems like from these comments. And we all knew this was happening. The amazing thing here is they're admitting it. Now, the Dallas Fed president said he was actually critical of the fact that they did that. He wasn't saying, you know, that this was something they should have done. He said this is, at least as I recall the statement, is he was saying this is effectively what we did. Now, I don't believe that he was in favor of that. I'd have to go back and look at those comments. But obviously, this Fisher at the New York Fed is a clear proponent of it based off of what he just said. And Yellen. Let's discuss Janet Yellen. A number of times, Fed Chair Janet Yellen, she has complained about rising, you know, inequality. Wealth inequality. And without a doubt, it's going on. And without a doubt, the Fed is responsible. Because who is it that owns all the equities? Who is it that owns the stocks and the bonds that are going up in price here? Who is it? It's not the little guy on the street. It's the wealthy that own assets. A lot of people don't have any savings at all in the stock market or anything. You know, and let's go back and review the quote again. Negative rates are difficult to deal with for savers. And negative, that same thing would apply to low rates. So, and here we have food prices falling, as we discussed in the first segment. And the central banks don't even want that. They're offering, you know, 0% on your savings account. So all the people on fixed income are getting clobbered. And prices, at least on food, have started to fall here, and the central banks don't even like that. They want prices to go up. And it's really amazing amount of groupthink that we have at these central banks who just don't realize that when they worry about wealth and income inequality, that they are the sponsors of it. And they also wonder why people are mad. They wonder why people in the UK voted to leave the European Union. They wonder why people are angry in Italy and France, and they're going to these extreme parties here that are fed up with immigration. They're fed up with prices. They're fed up because they don't have a job. And it all points back to central banks, and these guys don't even see it.
So, Mish, big question is this. I mean, when you look at all the things we've discussed on today's program and everything is really that's driving these stock prices higher, these higher stock prices are not a function of stronger fundamentals, stronger earnings. So the longer this seems to go on, doesn't it make the ultimate crash that much worse?
It does. It's possible there's not a crash at all. I'm entertaining that thought. Let's just play a what if here. Let's say that we're on this mythical permanently high plateau. Remember someone in 1929.
Mr. Irving Fisher's famous
Irving
comment.
Fisher, yeah. Thank you. Said we're at a, stocks are at a permanently high plateau. Well, guess what? And people thought the same thing with houses, too. That we were, well, they won't really fall. They'll just plateau here. Well, it didn't happen that way. But let's just assume that a miracle happens and that stocks are at a permanently high plateau here. And let's say that this lasts for 6 years. Okay, the average pension plan in the United States is assuming 7.5% returns on their pension plans. Well, what happens if it's zero for 6 years? You know, they're all going to be insolvent. In Illinois, the average state pension plan is something like 32% funded. Guess what happens to those in 6 years? If there's not just negative returns, but guess what happens if returns are just flat for 6 years? So even this plateau isn't going to work for all of the promises that we've made. And so I don't know what central banks are going to do. No one knows. No one knows the order. I'm a firm believer that there's a serious currency crisis coming up somewhere. It could start in Japan. It could easily start in Europe. I don't think it starts in the United States, but no one's going to escape this thing when it happens. And what we're seeing here is the rising price of gold is in direct correlation with faith in central banks. When ECB President Mario Draghi came out a few years ago and said, we will do whatever it takes, and believe me, it will be enough, gold fell from 1900 all the way down to 1100 bucks or so. And the people started believing that central banks were in control. The rising price of gold is in my estimation, a function here of people saying, you know what? What the ECB is doing isn't working. Merkel's immigration policies aren't working. What the Bank of Japan is doing isn't working. What the Fed is doing isn't working. So we're seeing a loss of faith in central banks. I believe that's what's behind the price of the rising price of gold. And I think that is the one asset class here where you probably still want to have some, you want to be exposed to the market.
Well, and Mish, when you look at where stock prices are today and adjust them for inflation, I think it was Doug Short that had a very interesting chart recently that adjusted for inflation, really, in real terms. Stocks haven't moved much in the last 15 years. Stocks gains are all nominal. So, I mean, if we see this plateau that we're hypothecating about, couldn't that plateau occur because of more easy money policies and stocks maybe in nominal terms stay on this plateau, but in real terms they decline?
Yeah, that's possible too. And when I said it was GMO that actually expects, and this is real prices, to decline about 2% a year for the next 7 years. John Hussman believes that it's more like 10 years, and those are real terms. But let's just say in inflation over that time, let's say it's 1%, then you're going to have even a 1% decline for the next 7 to 10 years. And if you say inflation is going to average 2%, then you're saying, well, stocks are going to average, you know, 0%. But in real terms, you're going to be losing 2%. Now, the pension promises have all been made out in nominal terms. So for pension plans, you know, they're going to be happy if they make their 7.5%, whether there's inflation or not. But it's a mess that central banks have gotten into, being in a position to where they actually now need to you know, directly support the financial markets. Well, you know what? They couldn't levitate home prices in 2007. I have my doubts whether they can, you know, permanently elevate stocks. Even if they can, a plateau is not going to be very useful for the pension plans.
Well, and that's another topic for another day. Our guest today has been Mr. Mish Shedlock. His website is mishtalk.com. Mish, always a pleasure to have you on the program, and we'd love to have you back.
Oh, anytime, Dennis, and I look forward to being back on the show.
Sounds great. Everything Financial Radio returns after these words. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program brought to you by PLP Services. In this segment, I want to share with you a bit from the book New Retirement Rules. And really, what I'm going to share with you this segment has to do with the fact that human nature really doesn't change. Because human nature doesn't change very much, history is relevant because human beings tend to behave the same way when faced with the same set of facts and circumstances. So if you want to learn what might happen in the future, it's important to understand what happened in the past. Winston Churchill said, if you want to understand the future, it's necessary to look deeply into the past. And that's what we're going to do in this segment to explain where we are today, economically speaking. Now, any of you who have read the book New Retirement Rules or maybe attended a New Retirement Rules class, understand that we believe that economies cycle. An economy cycle because human behavior is predictable. In fact, we break down these four economic cycles and name them after the seasons of the year. There's the spring cycle, summer cycle, autumn cycle, and winter cycle. And in the interest of time today, I want to talk to you just about the autumn and winter cycles. See, during the autumn season, because there's easy credit, there's easy money, debt accumulates until the system, the financial system that is, reaches its capacity for debt. And once no more debt can be added to the system, once the system has reached its capacity to handle the debt, the economic season changes from autumn to winter. And during this economic winter season, debt has to be purged from the system, which is a really painful process. Now, this happened last in the United States. Really here during the 1990s, we saw debt in the system rise to unsustainable levels. And since that time, the Federal Reserve has been engaging in easy money policies. In fact, quantitative easing is just another word for really printing or creating money in an effort to stave off or delay or hopefully grow their way out of these symptoms of debt purging that has to occur in the winter season. So just a bit from the book New Retirement Rules, once the debt in the system reached its capacity in the 90s, the trend of debt accumulation reversed, and it led to the economic winter season in which we believe we are today. Now, the economy seems to maybe be improving a bit, but that's due to easy money policies and really negative interest rates now are prevailing, as we talked about with Mr. Mish Shedlock earlier on today's program. Now, if you go back and look at the 1920s, they look a lot like the 1990s. During the autumn season of the 1920s, the debt in the system reached its capacity, and then the trend of debt accumulation reversed and led to the economic winter season of the 1930s, which, of course, we all know as the Great Depression. Now, this has happened time and time again, historically speaking, where we see an autumn season turn to a winter season. The cycle has repeated itself four times now in U.S. history, and there are a lot of other historical examples proving the existence of this cycle going all the way back to Greece in 486 BC. Now, if you look at the first autumn cycle in U.S. history, it occurred from 1821 to 1836. And this autumn cycle from 1821 to 1836 was predictably followed by a winter cycle. Now, how did this happen? Well, the Second Central Bank of the United States was chartered in 1817 when the country was dealing with massive debts that were accumulated during the War of 1812. The Second Central Bank, like today's central bank, the Federal Reserve, printed currency. Then, after the bank's charter wasn't renewed 20 years later, state and regional banks were allowed to issue currency, and this resulted in even more easy money and even more widely available credit. Now, without widely available easy credit, the system cannot reach its capacity for debt. In order for the system to reach its capacity for debt, you've got to make it really easy for almost anyone to borrow money. And unless you make it really easy for people to borrow money, price bubbles can't form. Now, in the 1830s, this economic autumn season transitioned into a winter season. A real estate bubble formed and subsequently burst. Land sales went crazy. Between 1830 and 1836, land sales increased 1,000%. And then in the panic of 1837, stocks crashed. And when debt-fueled asset bubbles burst, the banking system has trouble. You all remember the two big-to-fail banks were bailed out here in 2007. Well, way back in 1837, there was no bailout. There was essentially a bail-in because out of the 850 banks in existence in the United States at the time, 350 banks failed completely, and another 62 experienced a partial failure. That was half of all banks. Now, if you just turn the clock ahead, the next autumn season began in 1866. Price bubbles and assets formed once again, and easy credit was once again the cause. Now, in 1863 and 1864, the banking rules were changed. See, up until that time, only state banks existed, and the federal government had no control over them. But the National Banking Acts in 1863 and 1864 created nationally chartered banks. These nationally chartered banks had as assets gold, silver, and government debt. Each national bank could issue its own currency, but it was limited in the amount of currency it could print. The bank could print currency to the extent that it owned government debt to back the currency. However, this change in the backing of the currency, changing the currency backing from gold and silver to gold, silver, and government debt, expanded the currency supply significantly. And after the Civil War, easy credit was easily available as a result of currency printing. And like other times, when there was abundant easy credit, asset price bubbles formed. During the autumn season of 1866, mortgages were easy to get. Large banks were more than glad to make loans to developers. Half-built buildings were accepted as collateral for many of these mortgages because almost anyone could get credit. And not surprisingly, a housing bubble formed. The Long Depression of 1873 set in, and real estate prices collapsed, as did stock prices. Now, as I've already alluded to in this segment, this pattern repeated itself once again in the 1920s. The newly formed Federal Reserve, which was the nation's third central bank, and it's the same central bank that's in existence today, was founded in 1913. After the central bank was founded, the backing of the U.S. dollar by gold was reduced to 40% of its prior level, which allowed for an expansion of the currency supply. Well, that once again led to widely available easy credit. An economic autumn season now known as the Roaring Twenties led to the Great Depression. Bubbles in real estate formed in the 20s, as well as the now famous bubble in the stock market, which burst in 1929. However, Florida was the site of a real estate bubble in the 1920s. In fact, when you go back and read some of the articles that were published, they describe something along the lines of a collective madness that consumed Florida investors. City lots in Miami were sold as many as 10 times in a single day. However, whenever asset bubbles form, they always burst. And the 1920s was no exception. Now, if you take a look at the easy money policies of late, these really began in earnest after the stock market decline of 1987. Then, Alan Greenspan, who had just been appointed Federal Reserve Chairman, decided to provide liquidity to the economy by reducing the Fed funds interest rate from 7.5% to 7%. Well, if you take a look at what happened, the economy did pretty well, and Greenspan then did raise interest rates back to over 9%. But during the recession of 1990 to 1992, interest rates dropped to as low as 3%. However, they did go back up to 5.75% by 2000. But all this cheap credit and easy money allowed the debt bubble to build to unsustainable levels. We saw a stock market crash back in 2000 and 2001. Interest rates were reduced. We saw another crash back in 2008. Interest rates were not only reduced, but now quantitative easing or currency creation has occurred as well. When you look around today, the real estate market is hot. Right here in the West Michigan area, you see multiple offers, multiple full price offers on properties all within a week of a house being listed. Stocks are at all-time nominal highs as well. And while it's very difficult to predict the when, the what, when you study history, is fairly easy to predict. Now, we talk more about this at our New Retirement Rules class. If you'd like to get more information, you can go to newretirementrulesradio.com. We also touch on it at our Social Security Maximization Workshop, which is a free workshop. We have workshops coming up on September 8th and September 13th. You can get more information or you can register while capacity remains by visiting the website socialsecurityradio.com. The website, again, is socialsecurityradio.com. And if you would like to listen to any of the interviews that I do with the guest experts here on the Everything Financial Radio program, all you need to do is visit the website, everythingfinancialradio.com. The website, again, to go back and listen to any of our interviews with our guest experts is everythingfinancialradio.com. That's our program for this week. I certainly hope you got something you can use. Just a reminder, we'll be back next week at the same time. And another quick reminder, socialsecurityradio.com is where you go to register for the free Social Security Maximization Workshops. One will be held on Thursday, September 8th at Stonewater Country Club. The other on Tuesday, September 13th at Boulder Creek Golf Club. Again, the website, socialsecurityradio.com. Talk to you again next week.